my happy home to see what I could find out. I left my folk and friends with the aim to clear my mind out. Hit the roundy road, many kinds I met there, many stories told me all of the way to get there. Ooh. So on and on I go, the seconds tick, the time out, there's so much left to know when I'm on.
Welcome to Unspun, an experiment of truth-telling on KKRN 88.5 FM. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers, advocates, and activists from around the world. We're streaming live on the internet. Go to kkrn.org and click on the listen button. Unspun is normally a call-in show, but today's show is pre-recorded, so we will not be taking calls in the studio. You can send me an email at unspun@kkrn.org if you have comments, suggestions, or questions, and you can follow me on Twitter at DougBennett15. Well, our guest today is Alex Scrivener, policy officer at Global Justice Now in London. Global Justice Now is, quote, a democratic social justice organization working as part of a global movement to challenge the powerful and create a more just and equal world. They, quote, mobilize people in the UK for change and act in solidarity with those fighting injustice on social and economic issues from around the world. Most recently, Global Justice Now published a revealing report about the workings of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It questions the agenda and real motivations behind the foundation. So I want to welcome our guest, Alex Scrivener, on the phone from London. Alex, welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling.
Hi, Doug.
Hi.
Good to be here.
Yeah, good to have you on. Maybe you could just real quickly tell us a little about Global Justice, how you got started in general, and then we'll talk about the gated Bill Gates Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Well, I mean, Global Justice Now, I mean, we're an organization which is, you know, predominantly, you know, UK-based. I mean, almost all our members are here in the UK. But you might think that, you know, our name suggests that we're still global, but the reality is that the issues we deal with are global issues. You know, there's no such thing in the world as a truly local issue when it comes to dealing with poverty. You know, poverty is a global political phenomenon, and that's kind of, I suppose, the core principle behind a lot of our work, is that we try and fight the root causes of global poverty, global inequality, global injustice, both between countries and within them. So, you know, we may be quite a small organization, you know, based out here in the UK, but we very much are part of a global movement, I suppose, of global justice movement that kind of stretches across the world. So, I mean, we were set up back in 1970. We were called a different name. We were called World Development Movement. But, you know, since then, we've been sort of pushing the kind of progressive case for a sort of fairer world, and we've been doing that sort of ever since then, really.
Oh, I think you're kind of like a lot of groups here in the U.S. You're kind of in the center of the storm there in London, and much like activists and advocates here that are in Washington, D.C., and so you can have a great effect because you're right there in the kind of the center of where all of this is coming about.
Definitely. I mean, yeah, London is I mean, like New York, I suppose, a center of the international financial sector, you know, a sort of center of, you know, a lot of the kind of global economic processes that are taking place, most of which are detrimental to the vast majority of the world's population, you know. So, I mean, London is a very important place to be in terms of plugging into those sort of processes and ensuring that we're, you know, one of the voices calling for a different world.
But tell me, you have recently, Global Justice Now has released a report, and I didn't get honestly didn't get to read all through it, but it was titled Gated Development, and it talks about the Gates Foundation and their motivation. So maybe you could give our listeners a synopsis of what that's about and why we need to be concerned with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Look, I mean, there are more evil people in the world. You know, our argument is not, you know, that Bill Gates or Melinda Gates are particularly bad people. But, you know, these people have a very kind of positive image internationally. You know, they're seen as being, you know, look at these guys. Yeah, they may be sort of, you know, billionaires, but they've given away a lot of their wealth to good causes. You know, it's very, when I talk to people, it's quite difficult to talk to people about Bill Gates, actually, because people have such a positive view of what they do and what their foundation does. And what this report is doing, I suppose, is shedding a bit of light on just the extent to which these people have such incredible power over poverty, anti-poverty, healthcare initiatives globally, you know, sort of charitable initiatives that happen. You know, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are disproportionately powerful. You know, they have a huge amount of money. And this report, I suppose, is shedding a bit of light on the fact that, you know, not everything they do is great. You know, a lot of the stuff they do actually entrenches some of the kind of root causes of poverty and inequality across the world. It's very much about presenting kind of technological solutions. I mean, not that technological solutions are bad, but I mean sort of corporate solutions which are you know, I suppose, don't really challenge the underlying power dynamic and the underlying political system that's kind of the root cause of a lot of people's problems in the world. So that's a very abstract, I suppose, explanation of what we're doing. But
let me,
This
might be a good place to play a little clip that I have taken from Bill Gates' TED Talk. I don't know if you have TED Talks over there.
Yeah, they're everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't avoid them.
I think maybe somewhere in the Mongolian desert they might not have heard of them.
But let me play this little clip because it kind of, it's Bill Gates describing what he does. This was back in 2010. So let me play this and we can talk a little bit about what the foundation actually does. So here's a clip, Bill Gates, 2010 TED Talk.
I'm going to talk today about energy and climate. And that might seem a bit surprising because my full-time work at the foundation is mostly about vaccines and seeds, about the things that we need to invent and deliver to help the poorest 2 billion live better lives. But energy and climate are extremely important to these people. In fact, more important than to anyone else on the planet. The climate getting worse means that many years, their crops won't grow. There'll be too much rain, not enough rain. Things will change in ways that their fragile environment simply can't support. And that leads to starvation. It leads to uncertainty. It leads to unrest. So the climate changes will be terrible for them. Also, the price of energy is very important to them. In fact, if you could pick just one thing to lower the price of to reduce poverty, by far, you would pick energy. Now, the price of energy has come down over time. Advanced civilization is based on advances in energy. The coal revolution fueled the industrial revolution. And even in the 1900s, we've seen a very rapid decline in the price of electricity. That's why we have refrigerators, air conditioning. We can make modern materials and do so many things. And so we're in a wonderful situation with electricity in the rich world.
Besides being a misrepresentation of the importance of energy to poor people, and then he kind of corrects himself there and he says how important it is to the development of the rich world, which is closer to the truth. And, you know, I didn't want to play too much out of that, but he goes on to tell us how vaccines may save us as somehow applied to population control. I'm not sure. I'm kind of confused. Maybe you can shed a little light on this for me, Alex, because I hear it's, I don't know if you're familiar with Orwell, but I hear doublespeak. When I listen to these guys, it just doesn't all come together in my head. They say one thing, but it's like they're really pointing at something else. And so I maybe it's because they're in their little bubble world. I don't know why, but and I think your report is saying the same thing, that their solutions may not really be the solutions we need.
I mean, yeah. I mean, the thing is, I mean, the interesting thing about the clip that we've just listened to is we would probably agree with some of what Bill Gates is saying in terms of, you know, obviously climate change being particularly dangerous to the poorest people. I mean, if we look at where climate change is going to be most, you know, have the most effect, it's going to be in sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia, the, you know, places like Bangladesh, where, you know, at the same time some of the poorest people in the world also live. So in terms of the explanation of the problem, I mean, in that respect, I don't think we would disagree with him. But, and, you know, the key point here is that he talks a lot of the talk, but the question is, does he walk the walk? You know, and what does he think the solution to some of those problems are? And that's where we differ with Bill Gates. So Bill Gates' whole, I suppose, take on global poverty, climate change, these kinds of problems is we philanthropists, we rich people, we can solve the problem, you know. Few nice guys get together, bang our heads together, throw a bit of money at it, it'll be fine. You know, that's the problem. And that's where we disagree, because, you know, the kind of solutions that Bill Gates advocates tend to be the solutions that don't challenge the underlying power that he and his fellow philanthropists happen to hold. So, I mean, take, for example, I mean, all the sort of people that Bill Gates, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation work with in terms of solving some of these very real problems that he talks about. So, I mean, if you look at some of his take on healthcare, you know, which is, you know, some of the problems he outlines are really bad problems, and the things that obviously we would like to end. Like he says, you know, we want to end polio. I mean, definitely, we would love to see a world where we've seen the back of polio as a disease. You know, and there's nothing wrong with, you know, giving people vaccines on face value. But the way he does it is a way which entrenches some of the vested interests of the big pharmaceutical companies. He's doing this hand in hand with the likes of Pfizer, Novartis, GlaxoSmithKline, the really big health multinationals. And, you know, you might not think that's a bad thing in itself until you see who the real beneficiary of his schemes are. So, for example, there's a scheme called Gavi, which is you know, hugely bankrolled by Gates' foundation. It basically involves giving vaccines to people in poorer countries. And there's nothing wrong with that idea. The problem is that it guarantees a market for some of these really big pharmaceutical companies. So, you know, people like Glaxo and Pfizer, it pays. I can give you an example. GlaxoSmithKline and Pfizer both each get $60 per child they vaccinate. There's a vaccine which they use to vaccinate against pneumonia and meningitis, sort of bacterial meningitis, and those companies have got a revenue of $19 billion from selling these vaccines in, you know, all countries around the world. And this Gavi project is ensuring that it's their patented vaccines that get used in these countries, and that they are getting paid a guaranteed sum of money for doing that. The problem is that these same companies are the same people who are preventing the real solutions for health poverty. They're the people who are suing poorer countries for developing cheap generic drugs. They're the people who are really pushing hard on intellectual property rights for all kinds of breakthrough drugs, or even very mundane drugs that could really save lives if they were a lot cheaper for people in the global south. And what they're saying is, no, we're not going to let you, India, for example, produce this drug for $1. We're going to make you buy it off us for $50. And that's where the problem. For every vaccine these guys give away, they take away with the other hand. And that's the problem. Bill Gates doesn't see the bigger injustice that his projects are perpetuating in a way by making these companies even stronger.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Unspun, an experiment of truth telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. On the phone from London is Alex Scrivener of Global Justice Now. We're talking about the role of the Gates Foundation in world health issues. Today's show is pre-recorded, and we are not taking calls in the studio. Yeah, coming back to this, it's really a reinforcement of what I think is a predatory capitalist system that's spreading around the world. And like you say, it's under the cover of doing good, under the cover of helping the poor and healing the sick. And God, I'm almost making myself ill thinking about this. It's almost like an evangelical cover to enrich themselves. And I did look at some of the figures in your report. Bill Gates and Melinda Gates and what's his name? The other great, you know, one of the richest men in the world.
Warren Buffett?
Yeah, Warren Buffett. None of these guys have taken a loss in all of their philanthropy. They're not taking a loss, and as you point out, actually they're entrenching the powers that be that are working against local health organizations. You know, how difficult would it actually be if I was Bill and Melinda Gates to just go around to and vet health organizations around the world and give them the money directly and let them spend it? But wouldn't that be empowering people?
Well, actually, weirdly, that's kind of what they're doing, but they're doing it in a very sort of, in a way which kind of entrenches their power. So, I mean, just to go back to the point you made a second ago, I mean, people say sort of, you know, how kind Bill Gates is for giving away all of his money. The fact is, he hasn't done that. You're absolutely right. I mean, this guy is getting richer and richer and richer. For every dollar he gives away for some of his charitable activities, he's winning more than that money back in terms of his business activities, despite the fact he's not doing anything productive anymore, just through equity investments. So, for example, you know, back in 2001, he was worth $56 billion. Now he's worth $79 billion, despite the fact he's given away a lot of money in that time. So he's made $23 billion in just 4 years. And that is about the same amount of money that Bill Gates has given away in the whole of his time, well, the whole of the existence of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So, you know, he may be giving away a lot of money, but at the same time, he's making more money back. You know, so he's absolutely not dealing with the kind of system which allows people like Bill Gates to be so powerful. And that's the problem. You know, you can give away a bit of money here and there, but the system is the problem, and he's not willing to deal with that system. In fact, he's still profiting from that system. Because he's making more money than he's giving away. But, I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, what you were saying is absolutely right. You know, this guy is very much plugged into the kind of the system, and he's very much, his interests are very much about promoting the system. You know, maybe, I'm sure personally, I make this very clear, I don't think Bill Gates is an evil guy. I don't think he's someone who... I believe that he genuinely believes that he's doing good for people in poor countries. The problem is, I just don't think he's right. The way he goes about it solidifies corporate power rather than undermines it.
Well, to me, just as a historical aside, I don't think he's all that ethical a guy. I was very closely watching in 2000 when the monopoly that he has, which he came about in not the most ethical of ways, of the IBM PC software operating system, was something that was supposed to be broken up in 2000. And, I mean, it was right there. The court had already decided. But guess what? He started shoveling money to the George Bush campaign. And Microsoft, before that, had never really been involved in politics. Now they found a way. So they corrupted the whole case against them and slid out of it without having his monopoly destroyed. So this is not the most ethical guy. He knows how systems work. He knows that he can have influence and he can buy it. So I'm not quite as kind as you are, actually. I think his motives... you know, he might be trying to claim some place in the world in the legacy of Bill Gates.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't think he's... I think you're interpreting what I'm saying slightly differently. I don't think his business model is particularly ethical. I completely agree with you. I mean, the way he carved out monopoly at Microsoft, used every dirty trick in the book to solidify his market position. I'm not saying that behavior is ethical at all. What I'm saying is, I think in terms of his charitable work, in terms of what he's doing with the foundation, I think he, I mean, I don't know him, I don't live in his brain, but I suspect that, you know, him and quite a lot of the other philanthropists probably genuinely think they are doing good. In that respect alone, I don't think these people are particularly ethical in their business practices. I think quite the opposite. They're the ultimate in culture capitalists. They're the most successful people within that quite dog eat dog kind of world. I think we it's a bit of an aside really to talk about what Bill Gates really thinks or whatever. We're not going to be in his mind. The problem is that this guy has too much power. Whether he genuinely believes that he's doing good or not is a bit irrelevant, really, because this guy is not only the richest guy in the world, he's one of the most powerful people in the world, and he's, I suppose, narrowing the range of things, range of solutions that we can realistically talk about in the mainstream. So, this guy just funds so much stuff that very few people are even willing to criticize him. I mean, that's one of the big parts of the problem. I mean, take the World Health Organization, for example. The World Health Organization is a UN body. It's perhaps the biggest sort of health-related, organization in the world. Bill Gates, or his foundation, is the second largest contributor to this UN body, and provided 11% of its entire budget in 2015. And here I'm seeing in the UK, I mean, the UK is like one of the top 10 biggest economies in the world, has one of the biggest aid budgets in the world. But Bill Gates' contribution to the World Health Organization is 14 times bigger than the UK's entire contribution as a country to the World Health Organization. So when you have like that amount of money going into like the UN, it's not even a charitable sort of organization; it's an intergovernmental organization. Their priorities are going to be swung and sort of be defined increasingly by what Bill Gates thinks is acceptable. And so many health related initiatives are funded by this one foundation that it's increasingly difficult to find people who are willing to criticize him, and that's a dangerous situation. Even if he was perfect, even if Bill Gates was doing nothing but good, that amount of power in one guy's hands, that can't be a good thing in any, in any kind of sector or any sphere of work. So, it's not just about what he does, it's also about the amount of power that his money is giving him, And the solution is not for him not to give the money away. The solution is for the system to be different. It should be impossible for someone to be so dominant and to have so much money in the world, essentially. There's the level of inequality in the world where, I think it is 67 billionaires have more money than the bottom half of the global population. I mean, that's a ridiculous statistic. If you think about 67 people, individual people, have more money than half of the world's population put together. That is the problem. And if Bill Gates were to put his money towards changing that system to ensure that no one like him could get quite as rich as him or as powerful as him ever again, then that would be a much more positive use of the money that he's managed to collect for himself.
And I can't agree with you more. And if we look at the history, actually, the U.S., we are the illegitimate spawn of British imperialism, and we're going out in the world with that same attitude. And people like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and who did you mention before, the great venture capitalist? I forget his name now, but these guys are the poster children for the elite. These guys are the ones that are the examples of how to work in the world, create wealth, and take power to yourself and your friends, and which is totally against the concept of democracy. And I think that's what we're looking at. We're looking at the failure of democracy. And I don't want to give Bill Gates too much time, quite honestly. In fact, I think we could just lump him with the rest of the predatory capitalists, as far as I'm concerned. He's not about giving up power or really philanthropy when it comes right down to it. Yes, he's helping some people with polio, trying to eradicate that. I think they claim to have eradicated polio in India a couple years ago. But all you have to do is go across that little line on the globe there that says Pakistan or Afghanistan or any other country around there, and you're right back to it. And it's going to get worse with global warming and all of his work on these malarial and other diseases that, you know, that people like GlaxoSmithKline and Pfizer have made outrageous profits on, as you pointed out, at the expense of people's health. So let's move away from him. I'd like to talk about what we're going through here in America. We're going through this, having the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement shoved down our throat, kind of secretly, almost totally secretly. We've only recently been given a copy a few months ago here in the U.S., and I know you've gone through the same thing with the EU. And so maybe you could tell us how that plays in, these trade agreements play in with the predatory capitalism we see in our world, and how that is going to help to have corporate power over all the democracies in the Western world. It just boggles my mind that these guys are right out planning this basically coup of democracy around the world. I think both the trade deals, the TTIP, Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, both of these trade agreements would represent over 70% of the economy of the world, and we would be – why would we do that? That's my question to you, Alex.
Yeah, I mean, first, before I talk about the TTIP and TPP more in more detail, I mean, I think you're a bit hard on yourselves over there in the U.S. I mean, you know, it's you have – you know, at the moment there's, you know, things are happening over there that, you know, a few years ago I would have thought would be unimaginable. I mean, look at, you know, the Bernie Sanders campaign. You know, a few years ago I wouldn't have thought it was possible for someone who's so critical of stuff like TPP and TTIP and all of these trade deals to be really gaining so much momentum in the primary season. And, you know, even Hillary Clinton is now sort of being forced to be a bit more critical of these trade deals. So, you know, you can call yourself sort of imperial spawn of the British Empire or whatever, but I wouldn't be so hard on yourself. I would say, you guys have got a great opportunity now to get out there and really campaign for the big changes in the economic system in America. People are angry with the way things have gone. You know, people in America have lost out, you know, not just people in poorer countries. You know, and I think people are starting to wake up to that a little bit, to extent to which, you know, people haven't done for a long time. And this may just be the beginning. So, you know, don't get disheartened, you know, don't beat yourselves up too much, because, you know, America is just as much, you know, in some ways you're quite lucky, you know, being in the heart of, you know, perhaps the world's greatest sort of capitalist sort of economy, you know, you have real leverage for change if you get together and get organized, you know, and you know, the same for us to a much lesser extent here in the UK. So, you know, don't be too despondent about that. But to talk about TTIP and TPP and all these trade deals specifically, I mean, yeah, they are perhaps the biggest challenge to democracy we've seen for many, many years. I mean, TTIP, for people who don't know what these things are, I mean, the clever thing about these trade deals, they sound incredibly boring. You know, TPP, TTIP, TAFTA, CETA, all of these different acronyms, all these letters, they're designed just to bore you to death, you know, to make you think that actually this is just quite a technocratic kind of boring intergovernmental process. Well, actually, these trade deals could really undermine American democracy, could really undermine European democracy, and actually they're already undermining you know, democratic processes all over the world. You know, so, I mean, just to explain quickly, TPP is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, so it's a kind of trade deal between the U.S. and a number of kind of Pacific Rim countries like Japan, Malaysia, Australia, New Zealand, and a few others. TTIP is another trade deal called the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. So it's kind of the same thing, but with Europe, so between the European Union and the United States. And there's another deal called TISA, which is about services, which includes both some of those Pacific countries and the European countries. But that's, so, I mean, all of these different trade deals are going on, but they are not really about trade, you know. It's kind of like, I mean, I suppose the closest thing that we've had so far is NAFTA in North America. And NAFTA was sold very much as being a kind of free trade deal. You know, let's get trade going with Mexico, get trade going with Canada. And, you know, if it was all about free trade, I don't think so many people would be so angry. Because the thing with these trade deals, and, you know, TPP and TTIP are like NAFTA on steroids, you know, it's actually not the trade aspect which is most controversial, but what they call the investment aspect. So this is about giving multinational corporations essentially rights, you know. So, you know, back in the 18th century when you guys were putting together the sort of Bill of Rights and, you know, all of these, you know, human rights, individual rights to people, you know, now in the 21st century we're kind of coming to a period where we're giving corporations rights. In fact, human rights, individual rights are becoming less important. So to talk specifically about, you know, what we're seeing in some of these deals, there's a kind of parallel legal system that's being kind of created and has already, you know, been created in a lot of these deals called Investor-State Dispute Settlement. Again, a very boring title. It's designed to kind of, you know, make you think, God, I don't want to hear about it. But actually, what it is about overriding national court systems. So, for example, if I, as a British investor, if I got like a, you know, $1 million and I sort of invest in a kind of, an oil rig, for example, in the U.S., and I spill lots of oil everywhere, I ruin the environment, and, you know, the government of California say, you've ruined our environment, please go home. You know, we're taking back these resources, you know, you've messed up. Then I can sue the United States through this international court system to say, look, you can't tell me to compensate people for ruining their land, for polluting their environment. You know, I have rights as a corporation, as an investor, I can, and I don't care what the local courts say, the Supreme Court could say that, you know, these guys were in the wrong, these investors were in the wrong, this British guy has ruined our environment, he doesn't, you know, he's wrong in the eyes of the law. But these corporate lawyers who meet in secret can decide that, no, the Supreme Court doesn't matter, what we say matters, and the US government must compensate the British investor for doing, for kicking him out of the country for doing the oil spill. So that's a hypothetical example. There are many real examples that have actually happened, because this ISDS mechanism already exists between the US and Canada as part of NAFTA. So, I mean, the Canadians have had it really bad. There's a company called Lone Pine Resources in Canada. So they sort of, you know, wanted to do they were, you know, involved in the fracking industry. And the government of Quebec decided that actually we don't want to have fracking. We think it's bad for the environment. We're gonna have a moratorium on fracking. We're gonna temporarily ban fracking in the state. What did the company do? They took Canada to court, and they're in the process of extracting a huge amount of money in compensation. In Egypt, there was a similar deal that's already in force, and a kind of environmental services company called Veolia is currently suing Canada because it decided to introduce a minimum wage. You know, so, like, the crux of the system is, if you make any kind of decision, political decision, that gets in the way of what the corporations perceive as being their interests, so if you pass a law in California or any kind of proposition that threatens corporate profits in any way, you can be sued under this ISDS corporate court system. And that is very dangerous for democracy. It means that every time the Californian state government says, okay, let's introduce new environmental regulations, let's increase the minimum wage, maybe at the federal level, these kind of decisions could be challenged by these corporations through this court system. And it doesn't matter if the Supreme Court says you're right. What matters is this kind of closed system of corporate lawyers is eating in a secret room in, it's usually Zurich, I think, you know, they can say that you've got to compensate these countries for doing things like increasing the minimum wage, banning fracking, or whatever other kind of regulation that the government might think is right. And this is incredibly dangerous for democracy. And that's perhaps the worst aspect of these trade deals.
I read that last week in Brussels, Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth, EU activists actually chained themselves together to block these talks. And I know here in the U.S., you gave us way too much credit, quite honestly. I think as you'll watch, you'll see how this electoral system works. And Bernie Sanders will either be compromised or eliminated. And we're going to have once again some fake dichotomy to choose from the U.S. electorate. But really, there's so much money in the U.S. In these things. Well, all you have to do is look who's running. You pointed out that Bernie Sanders is the only one that probably has popular support. But will he survive it? I'm not so sure. And if he does get in there, you know, campaign promises. We looked at what Barack Obama did. He made all kinds of promises, has followed through on hardly any of them, and has become basically a Wall Street shill. So I think your faith in the U.S. system is misplaced.
Well, I don't have any faith in the system. You're putting words in my mouth. I have faith in the American people to change the system.
Okay.
I have zero faith in the system. I know it's rigged. I know Bernie Sanders is not going to win, probably. But, I mean, the fact that there's a big movement and that American people are starting to kind of come together, that is what is encouraging.
Yeah, I didn't mean to put words in your mouth. Those are my thoughts, anyway. But coming back to what happened in Brussels last week, I really think anywhere in the world right now that direct activism is the answer, and I've had several direct activists and supported and, you know, been arrested myself. I put my money where my mouth is, and I walk the walk. And so I'm wondering what part of global justice now is involved in direct action, and who do you work with over there to make things happen?
It's a controversial subject. I mean, we as group, we have a sort of developing position, let's say, we absolutely understand why people go for direct action. I think it's vital that there are people who are willing to kind of put their money where their mouth is, so to speak, and sort of get out there and sort of, show the world that, it's not enough just to be talking about stuff. You know, it's a very effective kind of protest technique as well. We, as Global Justice Now, we don't tend to do this as an organization ourselves. I mean, we're happy to kind of, support people, and perhaps give people moral support who do that kind of thing. But legally, we don't, ourselves, we don't really partake in doing direct action as an organization. We do things that are very close to direct action. So we protest, we do confront people in power with the reality of what they're doing. You know, we try and do this in sort of creative and interesting ways. You know, and I'm sure many of our supporters, many of our grassroots, we're kind of a grassroots organization, really, are also involved in direct action activities. You know, so, I mean, our as an organization, our kind of position isn't completely settled on that issue in terms of what we do. But, you know, it's vital that people, you know, are willing to kind of go the extra mile and really kind of show the authorities and the powers that be that they mean business. You know, sometimes direct action is the best way of doing that.
Well, certainly you provide information to groups. I know you have a lot of great stuff on your website. And so I know you're providing that to activists and to other agencies that are doing direct action. So what do you see, in the EU, and I've heard this term lately, we know what happened to Greece, which to me was a huge travesty of justice and a failure of democracy by the EU, but it's kind of an example of where we're all going to end up in these democracies that we live in. And I've heard this term. There was the Grexit, which is a Greece exit from the EU, and now we're hearing Brexit, which I'm assuming is British exit from the EU. So what is happening? Because the EU has apparently, according to Yanis Varoufakis, the former Minister of Economics, I think, in Greece was his title, we're in the process of destroying democracy in the Western world, and yet a lot of people are completely asleep. It's scary here. And you have faith in the American people. I don't have that much faith. That's why I beat them up, because I want to wake them up, because I really think the American people are pretty much asleep. But I wanted to ask you about the Brexit and what that's all about, and how that would go forward, and what would that look like?
I can sort of hear the sound of a can of worms opening now talking about Brexit. But Brexit. I mean, in this country, it's a very kind of divisive topic. I mean, society here is kind of split in two. And in fact, even the progressive part of our society is somewhat split on the issue. So a lot of people, I'd say most of the kind of progressive side of the UK spectrum favour staying in the European Union, but are very, very critical of the direction that organisation is taking. There's a part of the progressive spectrum who want us just to leave, but I think that's probably a slightly smaller proportion. The problem here is the kind of people, I mean, majority of people who are on the Brexit side, so the people who want to leave the European Union, are, you know, quite frankly, people like the United Kingdom Independence Party, who are formed, you know, there are a lot of racists, let's put it that way, a lot of racists, a lot of quite right-wing, kind of like, you know, the sort of category that I suppose in America support Donald Trump over immigration, you know, and a lot of people want to leave the European Union because, you know, it'll keep the foreigners out. And that kind of position is something that we, as Global Justice Now, and a lot of the progressive part of UK society completely reject. You know, we reject, you know, the sort of racist attitude behind those sort of arguments. On the other side, we are also very, very angry with what's happening within the European Union. I mean, unlike NAFTA, we're very lucky in that, you know, we have free movement between European Union countries. So in NAFTA, you know, goods and capital, money can move across between Mexico and the United States. But, you know, if you're a Mexican worker, no, you know, bad luck. You know, the poor aren't allowed to benefit from NAFTA in any kind of way. Whereas in the European Union, at least, you know, people have the freedom to move around and work in any EU member state, which is a very good thing. It's one of the best things about the European Union as it currently exists. Everything else, however, is terrible. You know, the European Union is a fundamentally undemocratic organization. You know, we elect something called the European Parliament, which is an elected institution, but it is basically not subordinate, but I'd say, you know, that's less powerful than the unelected European Commission, which is sort of this massive bureaucracy which is not really accountable very clearly to anyone, who, you know, kind of basically the direction of travel is towards more and more corporatization of our societies. It's towards a kind of, you know, welfare state for the rich and kind of austerity for the poor. And what happened to Greece was a very good example of how undemocratic organizations are, you know, the European Commission, the sort of, you know, is overriding the democratic will of the Greek people to sort of think of an alternative to the sort of very self-defeating austerity politics that's been imposed on that country. So, I mean, we it's a very complicated situation, really, with the EU. But, like, the I think a lot of people on the progressive side of politics here would like to see the European Union stay together. We kind of like the fact that, you know, we have free movement and people can kind of move around and be basically free, but we need to radically reform and change the organization so it is completely democratic, no longer, you know, with this big bureaucracy which is kind of imposing kind of very, you know, strongly neoliberal sort of economic ideology. So ironically, considering it's a very kind of statist bureaucracy on member states and on communities. So it's a very complicated situation. But, you know, ultimately, I suppose, on the idealistic sort of end, I would like to see a Europe where, you know, we elect and are, you know, all of these sort of these institutions become properly democratically accountable and are used for boosting some of the things we're most proud of in Europe. You know, for example, in the UK, I'm sure in America, you're told a lot about our socialized healthcare system. You know, it's one of the things most British people are most proud of. You know, those kinds of institutions, which are kind of common to more or less extend across the continent, these sort of social solidarity kind of projects, you know, those are the things that Europe should be about, not about, you know, a kind of regulatory race to the bottom, about, you know, more and more austerity and more pain being inflicted on the poorest parts of our societies.
You bring up the immigrant question, and we see, like you said, Donald Trump, and which I'm sure he has his counterparts over there yelling, "Be afraid,
Nigel Farage."
Yeah, be afraid, be very afraid, and the
like
sad
Donald
part
Trump
is
with a cigar.
But we saw what happened in France. So well, here in America, we went through this, you know, after 9/11, they yelled, "Be afraid, be very afraid, and let's attack everybody." And the American public went, "Yeah, let's do that." So I don't have quite as much faith in the people. I think there are great people out there, and I know they're like people in your organization that are committed to trying to make it a better world. But I really think that at some point we will have to face down and confront these corporate interests. You said the European Commission's not, responsible to anybody. Well, they are. They're responsible to the European banks and the big bankers in Germany. We saw who took Greece down without even a thought in that situation. Well, they're the poster child. We're just waiting to be picked off one by one, in my estimation. And America is not immune from this. We like to think we are. We have the crazy people that have the militias out in the woods, and they've got their guns, and they just think they're independent. And, of course, they could be squashed at a moment's notice. But they play with that idea that they're empowered. But everything that I see, and, I pay a lot of attention, been paying attention for a lot of years, I see this constant progression where democracy is going away and any empowerment of the people is being destroyed, like through these trade agreements and through agreements and systems like you have there in the EU. So I'm not quite as optimistic as you. Let me remind our listeners.
I'm surprised that I'm usually known for being incredibly pessimistic and grim, so it's great for a change to be the optimistic one. I mean, don't get me wrong, I don't think everyone, I don't have any illusions about, lots of people in America, like here, are racist and, not particularly switched on to the politics. But I just feel like at the moment, in both Europe and America, people are beginning to wake up a little bit. Maybe not a majority of people, but like more people than for a long time anyway. It's beginning to be a kind of movement growing. And I don't agree with everything that Bernie Sanders says, for example, but like I don't agree with him necessarily on what he says. I mean, about immigrants, for example, I think, I have different views. But the movement that these kind of candidates are kind of generating is a positive thing. So, I mean, in Greece, we had the Syriza. Obviously, that was crushed pretty much by the European Union's troika. In this country, we have Jeremy Corbyn, and sort of the sort of movement going on within the Labour Party. There are kind of increasing kind of sort of tendencies towards people who are asking questions about the political status quo. Now, not all of those questions will be the right questions. Not all the solutions being offered will necessarily always be the right solutions, but the fact is that there are kind of questions being asked about the system, which, perhaps to a greater extent than before. So don't get me wrong, I have no illusions that, the sort of majority of the American population or the majority of the UK population are sort of, ripe for sort of, calling for some sort of radical change. I don't think that's the case, but what else can we do? I mean, what else can we hope for if it's not for people themselves coming to a realization that things have got to change? Because if that doesn't happen, then there's no chance at all, really. So that's kind of our only hope, really. And I suppose in my heart, I'm just as pessimistic as you are, Doug. I kind of know there's kind of no alternative to kind of, hoping that more and more people will kind of question things and that more things will become open for debate and open for consideration than there's been before. I mean, in the 90s and noughties, before the financial crisis and even quite a few years afterwards, the phrase they used here anyway was there is no alternative. You know, there's no alternative to the kind of quite myopic, kind of narrow-minded politics of austerity. And that, you know, I think increasingly, you know, there is beginning to be a little bit of space for discussing it. Although, in other ways, it's very depressing. You're seeing all of these trade deals like TTIP and TPP going through, which, you know, are going to further squeeze the kind of policy wiggle room, so to speak, for governments to kind of to sort of, you know, push forward for alternatives. So, I mean, it's a mixed bag anyway.
I am pessimistic and cynical, and but I also have a degree of hope because I see hope in the actions of people just as you do. In fact, I see that as the only hope. And I'm hoping that when people hear this show, they start to understand where the real problem is. You know, it's not the immigrant or that person of a different color or race or ethnic background. That's not your enemy. They are just people like you, and they're willing, and you want to have, we could unite around the world around the idea of just roping the corporations and getting them back into where they started out. And that's, talk about a can of worms. When, you know, we opened that can here in America and turned the corporations loose, of course, the corporations weren't an invention of Americans. And in fact, much of the settling of America was through British corporations. So it's interesting history. And we are now, you know, seeing the fruits of these couple hundred years of corporate empowerment at the expense of the people. And truly, when it comes right down to these TTP or TPP and the TTIP, they're just more ways to transfer wealth away from people and away from nations, and with that wealth, power. My hope is that people wake up in every country and just simply say no. If you have to get out in the streets by the hundreds of thousands and actually say no. Just, you know, surround that building. Don't let any of those people negotiate, and don't allow your representatives in the parliament or the Congress to pass this kind of nonsense, because it's obviously one of the most destructive things to come along in a long, long time. We have only, I'm guessing, about maybe 10 minutes left in the show, and I'd like to get on to gloomier subjects. So,
it's been really upbeat so far. So yeah, gotta correct that.
Yeah, yeah.
Get even more depressed.
I know. Take a pill. Anyway, but nothing from Pfizer or nothing. self-medicate. But no, just joking. I want to go to something Bill Gates brought up 10 years ago. We've known for a long time that climate change is going to change the world that we live in. And I know that part of what you do and Global Justice Now does is look at that future. So what's going to happen in the world? It can't become a more just place, because that doesn't look like the alternatives we're given with climate change. So what's going to happen in the world if we don't face the challenges of climate change and come up with real solutions?
Well, if we don't deal with climate change, we're seeing a sort of disastrous situation, really. I mean, we're talking sort of a 6 to 7 degree increase in temperature. Well, at least a 4 to 6 degree temperature increase in the world, which doesn't sound like very much.
That's centigrade, right?
Yeah, centigrade. So, yeah, sorry, I'm thinking European. Yeah, yeah, so it's a lot more than that in Fahrenheit. You know, but I mean, whatever. It doesn't sound like a huge temperature increase, but it's a huge. I mean, it would basically mean, you know, a huge increase in famine, in drought, in flooding. I mean, we're already beginning to see the beginnings of climate change impact. You know, drought and famine is already becoming more frequent than it used to be. You know, we're seeing more natural disasters. I mean, you've seen nothing yet. This is just the beginning. You know, we've had not even 1 degree of global warming so far. So, you know, once we get this sort of five or six centigrade, you know, that will be, you know, the world will be incapable of supporting by then 9 billion people. You know, people are going to starve. People are going to be in a very, very uncertain situation. Millions of people are going to die, quite frankly. And, you know, that is a terrible fate. And it's going to affect poorer countries disproportionately, although it will affect places like California quite a lot, actually. I mean, you're going to have serious problems with water shortages, serious problems in terms of crop yields and the amount of food that you're going to be able to produce in places like California. So, you know, you're going to have, you know, it's going to be a serious challenge to human civilization. It's going to be, almost apocalyptic, you know, if we don't do anything about climate change. So it's absolutely vital. And it's only really in America that this is still a kind of subject for debate. I mean, most of the, and this is something where I think you guys can be a bit harsher on yourselves. in most of the rest of the world, you know, where is global warming happening? It's kind of a debate that's happened, and kind of the people who say it's happening have won. You know, the science is absolutely unanimous. Global warming is happening, and it's also been caused by human activity. And the only way out of climate change is to really clamp down on emissions. And this is a debate which everyone, most people, even some of the corporations, recognize now openly as being kind of that's the truth. The problem is that the kind of solutions they're putting forward are false solutions. They're sort of pretending to do stuff, but actually not doing anything at all. So some of the big kind of companies are talking about carbon capture and storage, which is a technology which I'd love to work, but actually has never actually been demonstrably effective anywhere in the world. So it's kind of like saying, I'm gonna take all this carbon dioxide and shove it underground. and it sounds great, you know. If it's possible, and you know, I absolutely, you know, it'd be great. But it there's no evidence that it's working yet. So by the time that technology gets to the sort of stage where it can be used on a high enough scale, it'll be too late. We'll already be signed up for like huge amounts of global warming. So we need to do stuff now, technology that's currently available. And the easiest way to do that is to invest more in renewable energy, solar, wind, you know, all those sort of renewable technologies. And the another important thing is to do it in a way which doesn't penalize the poorest people. So, you know, that's what we talk about, something called energy democracy. So an idea where, you know, we move away from kind of, fossil fuel systems, and we kind of ensure that the poorest people have control or influence over their energy system. They're not paying huge energy tariffs at the same time as transitioning over to renewables. Because renewables are fundamentally more democratic in some ways than fossil fuels. To have a coal power station, you need to have a big building, big turbines. It's very centralized. It kind of lends itself to kind of central control, whereas some of the renewables, especially in rural areas, it lends itself more to kind of energy cooperatives, more kind of small community solutions. I'm not saying that's the only solution to kind of energy, but like obviously in big scale projects as well. But especially in places like rural America, I mean, if you look at how a large proportion of the rural U.S. was electrified through energy cooperatives, you know, electricity cooperatives. And to this day, you know, if you go to many rural areas, the kind of energy is being produced through a kind of cooperative model. And in many cases, it's fossil fuels, it's coal, oil, and gas. But it can't be too difficult to move that on to a kind of more renewable, sustainable kind of footing. So, I mean, America, you've got a lot of the examples of how you can run a more democratic, more grassroots kind of energy system already there, you know. So in some ways, you've got an advantage over countries like the UK, which has never really had that tradition. But we need to start doing something about climate change now, because if we don't, then it's going to be too late. And, you know, it's the impact of climate change disproportionately affects the poorest people. So it's going to make the world an even worse place to live than places like Africa and South Asia.
Well, Alex, we are out of time, and with that cheery note, I think we're going to have to end our dialogue here. And so I want to thank you for being on Unspun with us today. And so thank you, Alex Scrivener.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. Our guest today has been Alex Scrivener, policy officer at Global Justice Now in the UK. Global Justice Now works around the world to support democracy, and You can visit their website at globaljustice.org. As usual, I'll put up links and other information about them, along with the archives of this show on KKRN.org. KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners and underwriters like yourself. So go to KKRN.org and click on the donate button to support our efforts.